Okay, well, this is the 12th lecture of the 17th ACC, March the 12th, 1957. I'm going to talk to you about survival. And it's about time. Sample process. Mark your mother with no future. Mark up your mother with no future. That's just a sample process of survival. What is survival? Survival is a continuing or persistent existence. It connotates continuance or persistence into a future. And this all by itself is the single most aberrative computation on the track I have discovered to date. One is being sent always into no havingness if he has nothing in his future to have. And if one is always being sent into no havingness, if he conceives the future to have no havingness, by an automaticity known as time, he'll hit the dwindling spiral simply on no havingness, and that is it. In other words, he'll start downhill because of that. Now, a person who has present time has either come back from into the future where he thought he was or thought there might be something, or back into present time from the past where he had something, and finds that he has something in present time. And this is very therapeutic. It's a very desirable situation to be in. But the point is, can you overdo present time? And that possibly could be an alternate title to this lecture. Can you overdo it? Yes. We have two processes now, one of which is then in our solids, and the other is a group of processes, all of which have to do with the future. And the running of these processes demonstrate that an individual goes back into the past in order to have a future up to the present. In other words, he remedies the lack of havingness in the future by going into the past and having a future which has already passed. You got the idea? In other words, he does a loop on the track. This is probably why we call them loops when they're stuck on the track. You see how that mechanism works? It's the only reason somebody gets stuck on the track. It always gives him a future. He always has a future. Security. A very pat future if he's stuck on the track. Because there's all that time between the point where he's stuck on the track and present time for him to have a future in. Many people look on time as the annihilator of all havingness. Each moment that goes by, it takes the universe away from them. It's a funny, funny computation. It's a rather amusing computation because we recognize at once that the universe is not being taken away from them as any more than it is being presented. But he knows, if he's in the past, that it has been presented many times up to the future, of which is called present time, for this fellow stuck on the track. He knows there's a future lying between his stuck point and present time. Well, knowing this is a great security to him because it has happened. Time has not annihilated it then. And this is merely an answer then to getting around this annihilation factor of time. All of those things which we have on every side of us are doomed to decay. Poets like Pope tell us. I love Pope. I think he's a great poet. I think he should have been born in Russia, though. I think he'd been better for the Russians. herself. He's a great poet. We're all lugubrious, unoptimistic, the stupid guff I've ever read in my life is this fellow Alexander Pope. It's gorgeous. But he takes up such nice questions as everything going to decay. And then I think there's a poem called Gray's Elegy. It doesn't come up to Pope, really, for lugubriousness, but it's bad enough. And these gentlemen and many, many more sing the constant song of there it is and it's all going to decay. There it is and it's going to decay. You see it, but that won't do you any good. It's rotting right this time. Yes, there she is. They can't look at a beautiful woman without realizing she's going to be an old hag. They can't manage this. They can't wrap their hands around the dollar bill without realizing that it's going to be spent. This, you might say, is the downgrade people go into about future. For a while there is a future, and then after a while the only future there is dwindling and wasting away and disappearing. That is the future. And then pretty soon they get into the state of mind of an atom, which is clinging so solidly to present time. Because there is no future. You can draw a curve of no future which will parallel the curve of the dwindling spiral or deterioration of any case or object. You might say it's less and less belief in the existence of the future. If you want to kill a man, kill his hopes and kill his dreams, and you'll do a very good job of it. Excellent. Job of it. I'm surprised that it's not a major course out at the UCLA, How to Kill Hopes and Dreams. They teach everything else about brainwashing. But here is the crux of any case, the make and break point, when the man still has a future and when he doesn't have any future. Now, this is survival. Survival is simply the promise of the future. One of the great journalists of the Middle West once said, I do not fear tomorrow since I have lived through yesterday. And he had given himself a little bomb there, which was quite interesting. But the question which interested me is, why did he need the bomb? Well, why did he need the soothing syrup of realizing that he would survive tomorrow, probably because he survived from yesterday to today. He needed proof that he was going to survive tomorrow. So he compared it with the past. And this is what almost everybody does. They'll say sooner or later, well, I'll get through it somehow. I've been through this before. And I've still gotten through. And there's probably a future. And in this discouraged sort of way, they recognize that this havingness will continue. Now, the discontinuance of havingness is a definition for us of non-survival. Non-survival is the discontinuance of havingness, and if you define it in that fashion, you will never have any trouble with a pre-clear, period. However, survival itself can become an obsession. One of the ways a person is made obsessed on the subject of survival is to have his survival thoroughly threatened. And if you can cause an individual to postulate his own individual survival and the non-survival of his opponent with sufficient violence, he will get an obsessed idea about his survival. He will get to a point where any little cut or scratch on his body will cause him to lie awake all night, sure that he's going to get blood poisoning. That any bump will undoubtedly start a cancer. That anything that happens to him is a warning of evil to come. There's nothing wrong with superstition, except it's a method of plotting future evils. Forewarnings. Well, now life is precious. There is no doubt about that. But when a person becomes obsessed about survival, he moves back on the first dynamic more and more solidly. He becomes more and more an only one. Since in a world which is subject to decay as well as creation, new building, I should say, the one does go up and down on the scale of potential survival. And one can see certain structures in his vicinity are going to decay, and he could also see, if he could believe it, that certain things are going to be moved. But after a while, people only see those things that are going to decay and none of the things that are going to be moved. So his faith in creativeness gets shot, upset, thrown aside, traveled upon on all dynamics but one. He knows that he himself may create something, but nobody else can be counted upon to do so. Thus, if the other fellow is always the cowboy in the black hat, the other fellow is never going to create anything into the future. So one becomes first dynamic on survival. And survival is composed, at its optimum, of eight dynamics. Will there be a future? Well, a bunch of gibbering idiots. They're too Waddington's much too good for these people. They ought to be turned over to the psychiatrist. Jumping around, Q&A-ing with their electrons and radiation isotopes and being dopes in general, have actually apparently threatened the future of all life. But all they've actually threatened is the continuance of the genetic line in this form. They aren't good enough to blow up the mass called Earth. They may be good enough to blow life off of it for a while, but they're not good enough to blow up the mass. To date, these people have not been able to as-is mass with a few hocus-pocus passes with a Geiger counter. They're not that good, and they never will be that good. Because maniacs seldom pick up solutions to anything. They'll just go on making things more complicated. People listening to that get an echo of no future. World could be blown up. Well, whole mobs of people can go into panics about this. One of the things that probably did as much as anything else to depopularize the Christian religion in the Western Hemisphere, where it is really taking a beating. Churches say that 2.4 more people came to church every Sunday this year than last year, but I'm afraid in most cases that's only 2.4 people. It's not on the upgrade. One of the reasons it does this is it panicked for centuries about the end of the world. Started out about the end of the world. Actually, probably what they really meant way back when they were just getting going and playing cops and robbers down in the catacombs. Possibly what was really happening there is Rome had sinned against the world, this is for sure. Rome, in her latter days, certainly, nothing of the majesty or respect she was accorded. That was in the end of her career. And he became very tired of her. Being very tired of her taxing everybody out of existence and calling people down to their Internal Revenue Office and giving them cross orders of one kind or another. They got weary of this, and Egypt got tired of sending all of its corn over for no cash. And nobody saw why a huge city on the face of the earth should be totally under the bounty and charity of the rest of earth. They began to dream beautiful dreams to them, and that was that Rome would disappear in a sea of fire. They conceived that fire and lava were suddenly going to spew up and engulf Rome, and they were amusing themselves, the pagans were, by the way, they were amusing themselves with this story for some time before the Christians came along. So the Christians made it factual and then turned this thing into hell and really got a good going on a line. Now, Rome considered herself the world. It was a synonym for the world. And they were even playing at this back there. Rome was going to end. And then the next thing you know, they could make a bigger effect by telling everybody that the world was going to end. And then they told everybody individually that he was going to end. And then they finally got it figured out so that if he ended and he hadn't done as he was told, he would fall into this lava, which was the molten city of Rome. But this somehow or other became seven hells, only one of which was lava, and the rest were ice and a hell composed entirely of psychiatrists. So they had some fantastic things. Dante, by the way, wrote the first textbook on psychiatry. Anyway, you get how this is. They were playing end of the world, end of the world, end of you, end of somebody else, end of this, end of that. And they got frantic about it so that within the last century, large mobs of people have stood out here in Illinois and other states alongside the great rivers and doing several times, following some prophets, clarion call that the world was going to end tonight. It was all going to end and God was going to make nothing out of everything. And everybody would go out there and stand around and wait for the world to end, carefully stocking up the wood stove so the house would be warm when they came home and so forth before they went. It was quite an amusing phenomenon. That's a mass hysteria. Man has witnessed this many times, and he will find many, many interesting accounts of the end of the world. One of the more recent ones was printed in Argosy magazine in 1949, whereby they said that all of the ice at the South Pole was beginning to melt, and that all that ice melted, why you get an axis shift of some kind or another, and everything would go to hell. And if all that ice melted, then New York City would go 36 feet under the water, and I've forgotten all ramifications. They had figured out where a gyroscope would swap poles if you unweighted one end of it slightly. And they seem to have a great deal of proof that this had taken place. It held water, but I got a hold of a gyroscope, and it didn't hold water anymore, because you can put chewing gum on the end of a gyroscope for a long time or take it off without the gyroscope suddenly assuming two new axes. It's quite amusing. This theory, however, was very convincing, and people were very happy with this theory. It was the end of the world all over again, now played in the realm of science. I looked up, by the way, in the weather records and found out it was getting much different. I think the article in Argosy magazine, just for the sake of accuracy, forecast that more and more gathering snow was going to unweight this thing. And it was the rebuttal on this thing, which was that it was all going to melt. And I found out that the temperatures and gathering snow and so forth of the Antarctic, by actual meteorological records of the Bird Expedition and so forth, did not hold good in view of any of their extrapolations, and so therefore the theory was for the birds. But they didn't care if that theory was for the birds. What did they want to do? They wanted to get in there with a big punch. They wanted to say, you've got no future. That's the game. No future. Not going to be any more time for you, brother. Time is running out. Now, people believe this so well that time runs out when they kick the bucket, that they actually can't remember their past lives until you give them a few jogs. Quite interesting. And this is phenomena to end all phenomena. They no longer have the mass there to look at, so they don't remember that they ever ruled. Quite interesting. This much occlusion is a fascinating study all by itself. How could somebody get that occluded? And why should people be so horrified when they suddenly unocclude? I've run into a few of those, too, you know. They suddenly remember they were John Jones. They ought to be going to the bank this morning. They left a widow and seven kids. They get upset. Just say, whatever happened to them? Well, they didn't have any future. So whether it's on the one dynamic or another, you get this. You even get this in the realm of gods. For instance, I've never denied a supreme being. I have been rather amused, however, at the insulated capacity and the numerous identity of the sub-gods which are worshipped here on Earth. They're quite interesting. They're fascinating. I mean, a long catalog of these things. We have one religion which talks about there being only one God and all that sort of thing. And the Muslims, they say that there's one God and then could promptly give you a God and a devil, but there are two gods. And then this is a different God than the Christian God, and the Persian God's a different God than that God, and it is run off into idiocies. If the majority vote was right, you see, the Christian God is wrong, because there are other people other than Christians on Earth, and there are Christians. See, so if democratic principles are used to decide these things, and everyone agrees they should be used at all times, I think the one God would probably be some kind of a household deity in India, or maybe an ancestor sitting in a grave in China. You get this terrific subdivision that goes on. Well, it would amuse you if they also play this game on gods. The word devil means little god, and it is a maxim of religions that the god of the old becomes the devil of the new. And the devil, which we know today, is partially borrowed from the Persians, but is taken in the main from the European god, Lucifer. And he was quite a god. They killed him off. In the process of killing him off. The end of that god is right. Similarly, the Christian god, or whatever they call god, the end of that god could arrive, and one day he will become the devil of some new religion. This is the evolution of gods. But people kill them off and give them no future, too. Yet, in religious beliefs, people try to take these deities and associate them very closely to this postulate of survival, so that they have infinity, eternity, they're always talking in long terms of time when they talk about God, so that may or may not be justified. But it is certainly true that this phenomenon occurs on every dynamic. Two phenomena then occur. One is the postulate that this dynamic, by itself and only by itself, will survive, and that the opposing forces or other dynamics will have no future. You see, you can get that on the fourth dynamic. Man might decide that he himself, as the fourth dynamic, should have total survival. We will survive. They've been attacked by the animal kingdom and so forth, and they decide this is all very bad. So they all decide they're going to survive, and they immediately knock out the majority of the fifth. They are working now in the direction of knocking out the third. They're just working in that direction. And so on. In other words, they're saying to the fifth, no future. So if the passenger pigeon, the buffalo, anything you could name that was good and edible is off this continent. It's practically thinned to nothing. I notice all the insects are still here, and they've all moved to California. Anyway, the insect population, however, is scheduled for slaughter. There's going to be no future for insects anywhere, but there's going to be lots of future for insects in zoot suits. Here's your fourth dynamic, making the postulate survive, obsessed with, and another dynamic being told that it has no future. You get this game's condition. Well, add it up on the dynamics, and you see how people get isolated into third dynamics. They get isolated into first dynamics, and it's an interesting mechanism that we behold here. Well, although that is the postulate, the closest phenomenon to this that would be attained by auditing directly in all cases would be an address to havingness. No future means no future havingness. It is time. Time ceases to be a postulate and becomes observable only in the presence of matter. Time is not possibly observed. It's not observed at all in space alone. Matter has to have entered the picture. So that we find time being directly monitored by matter. The less matter one can have, actually the less time one can have. It just works out that way. It isn't necessarily true that it works out that way in cases. So that with a reduction of havingness, an individual tends to conceive himself to have to be more important, bigger, more violent, in order to survive. In other words, he makes the survive postulate. You take matter away from him and he makes a survive postulate. You can make somebody make a super survive postulate simply by taking away from him a large amount of mass. Very simple. All right, he decides he'll survive. That's fine. Now, what if we take too much mass away from him? Well, then he dies, and the process of dying seems to include within it no more mass. No more mass either for that life or for a future from that life, and the person is now an entirely different person, thus the mechanism of death. An individual has had too much taken away from him, and he has no time at all. Therefore, there is no track to amount to anything that is clearly accessible to him. He closes off the entire track and is thus capable of knocking flat for himself the idea of future. In other words, he's fallen into the reverse side of the game condition and has become total effect on havingness. Now, if you make a person total effect on havingness, you can kill him. You say, well, it's this fellow Duke. He ruled all of outer Slavovia, and he was right in there and so on. And eventually, however, he had to withdraw. And, poor fellow, he withdrew to Monte Carlo and had a palace there and hot and cold blondes and everything he could think of. He rolled around in Rolls Royces poor fellow, you know. The guy's dying. Nobody could conceive why he's dying. He's lost his duchy. He's lost Lower Slavovia. It's gone. Somebody's taken it away from him. Well, his idea is that he should have Lower Slavovia. And you will find him either kicking the bucket or getting sick or spending the rest of his life plotting how he's going to get back Lower Slavovia. That's the best condition he will be in amongst men. The best condition is he'll be figuring out how to get it back. Now, there is havingness. You say, well, that guy has more than any one of us would ever dream of having. Right this minute, and there he sits wondering how to get back to this horrible country known as Lower Slavovia. Why is this? What is this all about? Simple. It's just a matter of his idea of how much he has to have. Now, you can always educate somebody in having to have more. That's easy. You can always educate somebody into having more. It's very difficult to adjust them into having less. Thus, we have a quantitative imbalance in the whole subject of havingness. So, it generally audits in the direction of more, 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 more. No reason why it should, except that people never get happy with having less. in the overall picture. Now, a person will tell you that he would rather have less something. He'd rather have less ants. He hadn't got enough ants. The cycle is lots of ants and then not that many ants. And at this time, you make the postulate that he doesn't want any. The little boy in the choir, or the nickel, the little boy in the nickel. And this little boy comes in and he demands a nickel. And he doesn't get a nickel. And he goes running down the tone scale and he cries for the nickel. And he doesn't get the nickel. And eventually, why, he goes into apathy and you offer him the nickel. And if he takes hold of it at all, he probably lose it or throw it away. In other words, he rejects the nickel. He tells you that he does not now want the nickel. This is the cycle of havings. Now, there isn't any form, no matter how poisonous or destructive or good or bad, there is no form anywhere in the universe about which a person has a reaction contrary to possession that that person has enough of. If he wants to reject it, throw it away, he considers it poisonous. If it's held against him or shot at him or something of the sort, it would hurt him. He would actually suffer pain from its contact. And that symptom is he hasn't enough of it. Even to handle or control something, one must feel there's enough of something. People cannot handle tiny, isolated bits of which there is none. But a person must have believed there was more of it before he could get upset about less of it. It's very amusing, these conditions that surround havingness are fabulously intricate to be solved so easily. Always on it in the direction of more, not less, for the preclear, and less, not more, for his opponents, you've got it. You say, now look. You mean to tell me that if there were 195 women in this room, that wouldn't be too many women in this room? Well, that's fine. Why, what criterion are you measuring it? Well, what's your criteria here? You mean too many women for them to be comfortable? Well, that would depend on their idea of how many women there should be in the room. Well, look, you'd have to stack them in. Well, somebody that, the people that ran the black hole of Calcutta so successfully, for themselves and so poorly for anybody else, certainly believed in 195 people to a small room. Wasn't bad for them. Well, it's bad for the people. I don't know what's bad for the people. What kind of women? Dead women? Live women? Capsule women? What is this? Well, there's a given space. Oh, what you're talking about is the density of women. Oh, that's a different thing you're talking about. You're not talking about too many women. You're talking about the optimal density of women. And women have to be just dense enough to hug, you know, and not so dense that they clank when you bring them up against you. And that density has several conditions whereby its form does not maintain if crushed in too tightly. So you're trying to preserve the form. Now, you're not talking about too many women. You're talking about the survival of women. So the moment we get into too many position, one way or the other, we have survival connotations with regard to it. In other words, 8 billion ants piled into this room are neither too many nor too few ants, except as you view it. But now, when you view the survival of your form and the survival of the ants' form, you see, why we have to take different considerations. But, get this, survival is always viewed from a viewpoint in contrast with other survivals. I guess, about the best rendition I ever did on this particular one can be found in Book One about duck hunters and ducks. It depends on who's surviving. Yes, but you, a Thetan, are not interested until you take sides. Now, once you've taken sides, you immediately adopt this situation. Survival for the side you've taken and non-survival for the other side. Which means you've taken havingness for the side which you've taken and no havingness for the other side. Which means you've taken future for the side that you've selected and no future for the other side. These are game's conditions. Just immediately and automatically, that's it. Now, it doesn't matter to what degree these sides are opposed. It may only be that one belongs to the ladies' sewing circle, and there's two cliques in the sewing circle. One is the governing clique, and the other is the clacking clique. And these two cliques are opposed. And the peak of combat which is reached is a remark such as, oh, my dear, I certainly like that hat. I've always liked it. No more violent than that, but this still comes under these delicately under these headings of future for the side, for the clique one is in, survival for it, and havingness for it, and that's no have for the other clique, you see. That's no future for it either. We'll drag this out till we duct you ad absurdum. If a woman looked always absurd in a hat, she never had new hats, or survival is being questioned at best. At least being questioned. Doesn't your husband provide well for you? Would simply be entering into the head of somebody the idea that they might be failing. And that is always necessary before you get anybody to make up his mind on these subjects. This is so elementary. It'll bypass you as an auditor, time after time after time after time. It's too easy. Used to have a friend who used the cliche all the time, shooting fish in a rain barrel. I was always attracted by that metaphor. Very, very good. Very good metaphor. But I was always a little puzzled. How the fish got into the rain barrel, what the shot would do, you see, to the bottom of the rain barrel, whether one would get splashed if he fired bullets, and whether he wouldn't get a flat ricochet and get hit yourself, all these other terrific considerations, you see, significances, on and on and on and on. You can see how many, you can just keep adding them up. What would happen if you did shoot fish in a rain barrel? Somebody says it's easy to shoot fish in a rain barrel, you immediately think up all these side considerations. It doesn't seem that easy to me, you see. Well, I tell you, these basic considerations of the game's condition of survival versus no survival, of future, which is almost saying the same thing, but not quite. Versus no future, have for self and no have for the other fellow, life for self, death for them, this sort of thing is all there is to it. Now you can say what happens if the bullet hits the water and splashes and ricochets and bores a hole in the rain barrel and what if this and that and wander around and add this thing up and get lost in the woods. You count the ghost bees, and I'm sure you will because I do every time I turn around. I'm aware of these fundamentals, and I'm aware of how they embraced me, and I've been aware of this postulate of survival now since 1938. But it has never deterred me from getting more complicated. Only recently could I demonstrate this thing on a sort of a miraculous basis. That was only after we had games, conditions, and havingness. We had to have those two things before we could do that, and we had to have the additional factor of control in order to conduct a proper auditing session. And only then was it possible to just take these little factors all by themselves and produce something like a miracle. Now, a very crude command is something like, mark up your mother with no future. Very crude command. But it works. Yes, you say, but look, there's an ally and I certainly die, and I'll go ahead, argue it out. Who cares? The basic computation is survival for self, non-survival for the other person. And even though you're trying to be friends and a teammate and everything else, there's enough of this kicking around so that it'll always run in any direction. There's the cowboy in the white hat, the cowboy in the black hat, and you know yourself, and you know you're good, but you know the other fellow's bad. You know, I mean, all of these various considerations that are in and make this a runnable process. Well, how about this process? Mark up your mother having everything she wants. Quickly just goes right out the bottom. Yet that's what he was always trying to do when he was a little kid. He said, that must have been very additive, so we ought to run it. Oh, no, we don't. You better not run it. It's a funny thing to have something that you just must not audit, which is non-survival for self and survival for the other fellow. Life for self, a life for the other fellow, but no life for self. Having this for them and none for you. They've got lots of future and you've got no future. It just doesn't work. You might get away with it for 2 or 3 commands before the pre-clear collapses. But when you're dealing with postulates and auditing procedures, they're simple, they're straight, they're direct. You can really see the effects of running a no-gain condition. Life for them and death for me. Mark up your money with the total potential of survival, totally surviving. Good. Mark up your money with total survival potential. Mark up your money with total survival. All of a sudden the pre-clear says, you know, I love my mother. She collapsed. It's as simple as that. Now, it doesn't matter whether a mother was a good girl or a bad girl or anything else. Any little kid will cry if you tell him that his mother's going to vanish. You can make any little kid cry by saying something's happened to his mother. Yeah, but that's the way life ought to be. That isn't the way it is. There's a vast difference here that you just have to differentiate. If you're going to make life the way it ought to be, then you better audit out the way it is. And this game condition is the way it is. Nothing bad about that. Many of them will tell you, look at the ample opportunity I have of getting into trouble in this culture at this time. No slightest doubt that I'll ever become barred. I can walk around any corner and immediately go to jail. I can sneeze and become bankrupt. Almost anything can happen in this society if they really are not dramatic in terms of havingness. Life is very undramatic in terms of havingness. So the young man thinks, I would rather go out and wrestle lions single-handed than to go down and argue with my boss at the bank. He believes this. Funny part of it is, it's easier. It's a recognizable game condition to strangle a lion. But he's supposed to be friends with his boss. He had all of his training, upbringing, everything else, the arrangement of the dynamics, the culture in which he lives, so forth, does not admit of that being audited. Does not admit of it being audited. It just doesn't audit. Mark of yourself as a friend of your boss. Mark of yourself friend of the boss. Mark yourself friend of the boss. Mark yourself friend of the boss. I mean, nothing wrong with this. You'll run for a long time before you suddenly notice that your preacher has yellow jaundice or hives or something. Run for hours sometimes. Now mark up the whole world friendly to you. Sounds so good. That's what the mystics want. Doesn't audit. All right, let's run something else, though. Mark up yourself as having killed everybody on earth. That audits. Now that's a wild one. Well, remember, a games condition is an unknowing games condition.
condition.
Has to be in order to be aberrative. So you actually have a hidden impulse. Now, Freud wasn't so stupid. He put his finger on the fact there was something bestial going on. But I think he assigned the word bestiality to some second dynamic activity, didn't he? There was some kind of a caveman haunting. I think the caveman stood with a club just two neurons south-southeast of the sensor. And he had a club or something, and every once in a while he tried to plunge up through the psyche, which I always consider an interesting thing to do, and assert himself at unexpected moments. Well, the funny part of it is he was exactly, Freud was exactly 180-degree wrong-vectored. A civilized condition buries all forthright action. When it's becoming too civilized, a person is being prevented from communicating. From what? From lions, tigers, and things like that, and he turns on his fellow man. Interesting things start occurring here. But man is basically good. And the stuff that's lying underneath all of this stuff that should be peeled off is actual basic goodness. Everybody should survive. Everybody should have a future. We all can own this. You got the idea? Fabulous. I mean, that's what's underlying all this stuff. Not some beast who will suddenly leap up to the psyche and strike about with a gnarled club. That isn't what appears. It takes auditing to prove that. We had the idea that the person was really a beast who was lying under a sensor, waiting to stab one and all. See, I mean, that was the way they had it rigged. But that isn't the way it's rigged. The guy that's lying underneath all these unknowing games conditions is trying to be a good fellow. Then he sort of gets going on a games basis. The games get more and more serious, and then they get scarce. And he gets so there's no excitement at all, and he gets so he doesn't like games, not enough of them to play. You get a misalignment, not only of an individual personality, but you get a misalignment of all of man's idea of man. Quite interesting. I think of man is basically good. There is no doubt about this. But in order to find it out, you have to run out the unknowing game's conditions. So you see, I'm not telling you that man desires survival for himself and non-survival for everybody else. No, his cockeyed acts of heroism, the various things which he does, of self-sacrifice, nose to the grindstone activity, tremendous goodness of heart, which you really see displayed here, there, and everywhere, all belie this fact. But he's gotten into this other condition, and when when that's audited out, he can come back to battery. What's wrong with him? He's been so untrue to himself. He has denied himself so unthoroughly that he says, only I survive, and they don't. And that's bad enough to have to be run out. There's nothing wrong with being in a game. Just know you're in one. Don't go struggling around in the middle of something. You say, I must be in a mud patch when you're really on a playing field. No, don't keep hitting people in the head saying, what are these telegraph poles? It's not much fun, but it sure is dark in here. You know, it's right. Now, if that's aberrative, it is actually antipathetic, then, to the basic nature of man. And when that's audited and cleared away, then you'll find the basic personality. You'll find out all these characteristics were pretty well antipathetic toward them. The person had to be put into an unknowing games condition in order to suffer any kind of a reaction from it at all. We can go ahead and play a game, we can clog with people and do that sort of thing. It was quite amusing. He's been restrained from being in an unknowing game's condition by life. And that's really something. So that you can at once find out what it's all about with a preclear, overlies the preclear. He's in an unknowing game's condition. For some reason or other, while he's lived on this block, he couldn't keep from hitting little girls with his wagon. And he'd go around and hit all the little girls with his wagon. Crash. People consider this antisocial. There he is. What's he all about? Well, he better not do it, that's for sure. Well, he really shouldn't be permitted to go on hitting little girls with his wagon. This is not good for little girls. This is the question of survival is invoked. So he shouldn't do it, that's for sure. But, when they prevented him from doing it and told him he couldn't communicate that way anymore, they then, he was already in an unknowing game's condition, they came along and they buried it. Well, sure, that's probably better to have him in apathy on the subject and busted all the little girls in society. But, look, there's a better way to do it. Much better way to do it. Just start it. Just use control all by itself, and he doesn't then have to react to the mechanisms which put him into the I'm supposed to concatenation, which winds up to be this peculiar game of hitting little girls. He's running that off, and you tell him to do something else, and you tell him to take some orders directly and straightly, and he's resisting taking the orders. Well, he's resisting taking the orders from this unknown game's condition, so therefore it can master him. He wasn't resisting it, it would never overwhelm him at all. So, you run him to straight through control, and he finds out some unknown source can control him. So, therefore, he finds out he can control himself, and it's very interesting to watch him come out of one of these dramatizations on a simple matter of control. Now, you can't do that with a little kid. If this little boy is running around hitting all the little girls in the neighborhood with his wagon, I can be absolutely certain that his parents were on rotten 8C. Just terrible 8C. They might be very nice to him. Everybody say, well, they're good parents. By all observances, they're fine for him. But this is the most peculiar thing in the world to witness. It is not whether they feed him well. It is not whether they clothe him. It is not whether they are nice or sweet or kind to him. These do not seem to have very much of an operating factor in establishing his goodness or badness, his smartness or his dullness, or any other factor. It's whether or not they run good, consistent control. Now, you can put misemotion in control, and it's still a little bit better than no control. The control run with misemotion, of course, is going to miss the vote, so you have to have good control, which, of course, all of us would have to contain good communication, which means good ARC. Then you get this fabulous picture of a couple of parents that actually don't do anything for a kid at all, turning out this crackerjack kid, you know? You say, what on earth is this all about? They didn't send him to school, didn't do this, didn't do that. I know they were mean to him because they never bought him a convertible when he was in high school. Mean to him. Didn't pay much attention to him. And sociologists and phrenologists and other people have tried to dig out juvenile delinquency, and they say it's a broken home, and they can get you a whole bunch of factors showing that 89.6% of all juvenile delinquents come from broken homes. Oh, that sounds so wonderful. The only trouble with statistics is that's what they're for, to sound wonderful, not to be true. 89.6% of the homes in America are broken. He might get down to, what else could you come from? This is even silly. And we find that the children of the rich, if there are any left, the children of the rich are every bit as susceptible as the children of the poor. And we have all these random factors. We say, well, is it income bracket? Nope. Is it whether or not they sure people have made researches on this. I'm sure the Wheaties Company has hopefully looked into this, and I'm sure that they found that 50% of the juvenile delinquents ate Wheaties. Otherwise, they long since would have used the figure. Don't become a juvenile delinquent, eat Wheaties. And they've isolated these factors. One child has a well-managed allowance, and another child doesn't have any. Oh, wow, you know, and they just keep mucking through this woods, and it all boils down to this, as far as children are concerned. Good control. Good control, you have somebody who is not necessarily obedient, good, fitted into the society. These are not factors which should go along with this thought. You have somebody who can exercise a power of choice. That can get deadly. You could have one of the freest kids you ever saw in your life still be quite rational. This is one of the more fabulous things the sociologists and phrenologists have never noticed. It isn't really any kind of a factor. Actually, having this has very little to do with whether one is rich or poor. It's the ability to have that counts. This is how much is available to be had. If you've lived around in very rich environments, you very often find that the limitations on usage of things and other things might act to be more destructive to having this than actually to live in poverty and own the whole mud bank of the Mississippi or something, you know. I knew a little kid once, richest kid I ever walked into. I met this little kid, and he was walking down a road. And he certainly had a long way to walk, and I picked him up. It was out in the valley south of Phoenix. And I told him I'd take him on down the road. He was going home. He thought that was nice of me in a sort of an offhand sort of way. He just soon walked, only 4 or 5 miles in the blazing sun. He was a Spanish kid. And he finally... riding along there, and was fine. He turned around to me and said, "Isn't my desert beautiful?" This kid owned the whole valley. I know who owns the whole valley from Phoenix to Tucson now. This little kid. This. Other people only own lots. But he owns the works. Had nothing much to do with the power of choice. You can say that because of food, decent food, medical attention, good clothes, and being able to stay warm and so forth, that the children of the better class of people have a better chance of success in life than others, but you've entered this factor of survival in now. And that is, say, we did have a better chance of living, and therefore had a better chance of at a lot of things. But this doesn't overthrow particularly the control factor. That means that a consistent, predictable future, I'll lay the bomb on you, is necessary to have anything. And that's where control fits in. With having this time and survival. Positive, predicted, unswervable motion and action. Positive and predicted. And that in itself is the essence of time and is the essence of future. And a person can be swung into this simply by heavy control. Little Johnny is raised by very, very poor parents. These people tell little Johnny to go down to the well, draw a bucket of water. Doesn't matter what they say, little Spaniard, he doesn't or anything else. What they've been telling him, to go to the well, draw a bucket of water. He knows at that point, as he stands on that doorstep, that there is a well, there is a bucket, he can predict his action. And he has to predict the continuation. continued existence of the well, or it's been predicted for him by somebody else. In view of that fact, look at all the future he's got. The length of time it takes to go to the porch, the well, lower the bucket, fill it up, dig it back up, and bring it back to the house. Everybody is certain that he's going to do this. Nobody's worried about him doing this or not doing it. He certainly, at that moment, has that length of time into the future, doesn't he? But Johnny, who is told to go over to the well, no, not the well, Johnny, I think I'd rather have you pick up the horseshoes you left in the yard. What are you doing with all those horseshoes, Johnny? He doesn't know any positive change. And time is change. He knows no positive alteration of position. He doesn't know whether he's going to be sent here or there, and he winds up with an anxiety about having this no future, and hence asserts his own survival above the survival of everybody else, because it's all up to him now. That's where cases break down. That's how they break down. That's what happens to them. Now, I'm not going all out and trying to tell you that mean, ornery First Sergeant King everywhere and so on is absolutely necessary for continued health of anybody. I'm only trying to tell you the positive, executed, acknowledged communications are the only things that gives you a fine, predictable future havingness, and therefore give you survival. Control can be run off in many bad spots. A lot of wrath can be called down upon it. But the wrath comes down on the misemotion, the punishment, the unpredictability. Well, these aren't control. What I'm talking about is good, solid, positive control. And that wins any time. And I want you to get a good reality on that until you can find out how these factors fit together. Because when you do, you will realize that you have methods of processing children, psychos, so on, which is due to lead pipe cinch. I mean, there's nothing to that. There will be nothing in you that is suddenly rebelling and saying, oh, no, I should be. Now he's just a little baby after all. Why should I ask him to do anything? He doesn't understand. He's just crazy. I'm psycho. Well, you can apologize yourself away from control and into failure. But life's been doing that too long, and I personally find it monotonous.